From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. British mystery writer Liza Cody's new book, Bucket Nut, introduces Eva Wiley. She's big, she's ugly, she's a professional wrestler, security guard, and petty thief. Cody's earlier detective series featured a more refined sleuth, Anna Lee. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with Cody about why she started writing about a bad girl. Also today, a poet and screenwriter who taught himself to read and write in prison. We talk with Jimmy Santiago Baca. He wrote the screenplay for the new movie Bound by Honor about Chicano life in East L.A. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new novel by Serbian writer Milorad Pavic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Fighting in Bosnia seemed to ease today, giving hope that the peace plan initialed by the Serb leader in Athens is having some effect. But the plan still has to be endorsed by the self-declared Bosnian Serb parliament, due to meet on Wednesday, and hardliners say they'll reject it. Richard Carruthers reports from Zagreb.
Five people were killed by a Serb artillery attack on Sarajevo last night. But during the day, clashes between all sides seemed to be subsiding. That didn't lighten the UN's workload. British soldiers escorted around 250 refugees, mostly Muslims, across no man's land to Muslim-held territory in central Bosnia. They're the latest victims of ethnic cleansing by Serbs in the north of the republic. A Serbian officer warned British troops that UN forces, as well as Muslims and Croats, would perish if there was military intervention. While meeting leaders in Europe, Secretary of State Warren Christopher said plans should continue for the possible use of outside force. But the Bosnian Serb leader, Radovan Karadzic, warned that U.S. threats of military intervention could provoke the so-called Bosnian Serb parliament to reject the peace plan. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
A group of retired military officers announced today that they will try to persuade Congress to write into law the ban on homosexuals in the military. President Clinton has said he will overturn the prohibition. The retired officers say they have created the Defense Readiness Council to lobby Congress and to raise money for the effort. They say allowing openly gay troops is contrary to military judgment and experience. The Israeli police minister says Palestinian police officers should be trained in Egypt and Jordan. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Police Minister Moshe Shachal said Israel Today presented its proposals for a Palestinian police force to the Palestinian delegation in Washington. He said it would include about 4,000 policemen armed with what he called light weapons. At least one sector of the Jewish population in Israel is vehemently against this idea. Representatives of the more than 100,000 Jewish settlers this morning staged a mock confrontation between Israeli drivers and settlers dressed as Palestinian policemen. Another group associated with the extremist Kach movement has renewed roving armed patrols throughout the West Bank. Some Jewish settlers say that if they are stopped by an armed Palestinian policeman, they will shoot first. They say it will be impossible to distinguish between an Arab policeman and an attacker. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
An attorney for David Koresh says Koresh's mother is angry that the public was told before she was that her son's remains had been identified. Koresh, the leader of the Branch Davidian group, was identified by dental and X-ray records. His body was one of scores found in the burned-out complex near Waco. Authorities say he had suffered a gunshot wound to the head. This is NPR. For the first time since the inmate takeover at Ohio's maximum security prison ended last month, the five guards who were held hostage during the 11-day siege are speaking out. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
The former hostages say they're glad it was negotiations that ended the siege and freed them. According to the guards, if Governor George Voinovich had given in to pressure to have 500 National Guard troops storm the prison, the rebel inmates would definitely have killed all their hostages. But while they praised officials today for their patience in negotiating, the former hostages also aimed some blame their way. Corrections officer Jeff Ratliff said the guard force was understaffed Easter Sunday when the riot broke out, and he charged if authorities had responded to inmate demands earlier, the way they responded on day 9, the siege could have ended much sooner. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Cohen reporting.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin said today that Moscow police did nothing wrong during May Day clashes with communist demonstrators. Yeltsin said officers had orders not to let the marchers hold the traditional May 1st rally on Red Square. Yeltsin says the police carried out their instructions precisely. Authorities say 571 people were treated for injuries, including 251 police officers. The clashes were the worst street disturbances since the 1991 coup against Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. Yeltsin's political rival, the Speaker of the Parliament, has ordered his own inquiry. The FBI has accused an American employee of the U.S. Embassy in Athens of spying. A Greek government spokesman says his government is unaware of the matter. Stocks closed higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 19 points to close at 3446.46. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 11-7. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In an era where thin is beautiful and the waif look is in, my guest has created a heroine who is big and mean-looking. The character's goal in life isn't to trim down. It's to become the women's heavyweight wrestling champion of England. The character is Eva Wiley, known in the ring as the London Assassin. Her creator is my guest, Liza Cody. Cody is a British writer whose earlier series of Anna Lee mysteries is being made into a British TV series. Her new book, Bucket Nut, is the first Eva Wiley mystery. When Wiley isn't wrestling, she works as a security guard for a London junkyard where she lives in a beat-up trailer. She also makes deliveries for a local racketeer. One of those deliveries turns out to be a parcel bomb, which is meant to blow up a nightclub and blow Eva away. But Eva survives the explosion. After lying unconscious for several hours in a ditch, she comes to and emerges, dazed, her clothes in tatters. And that's where this reading picks up.
I'm used to people staring at me, but usually they stare because I'm big and strong and mean and tough. I'm not used to being stared at when I'm weak and feeble and not dressed properly. It wasn't nice. I felt sort of naked. Well, if you must know, I was sort of naked. So I hung onto my rags and limped as fast as I could. It all goes to show basic strength and fitness do count for something. Getting home without falling down or going to sleep every 10 steps of the way was something a feebler person just couldn't have done, but I did it, so stick that up your nose and blow it out your ear. I bet you've been having a bit of a giggle at me all this time, a big woman making herself bigger and tougher. Well, let me tell you, I'm never sick. I don't get headaches. And when I get hurt, I can tough it out. What can you say about yourself, eh? Go on. How would you manage if you'd been blown halfway across a road and a door on top of you? I know you think I'm stupid. Don't try and tell me different, 'cause I know, see? And maybe I'd done a stupid thing. All right. But even clever people can do stupid things. You don't have to be all round stupid to be conned. Clever people can be fooled too. Hasn't anyone ever taken you for a sucker? Well, OK, I'm not judging you, so don't you sit there and judge me.
Liza, thanks for reading that. Would you describe Eva physically?
Eva is big, bad and ugly. I'd say she's probably 6 foot or over, and she's broad to match, but she's very well muscled. She's worked at that. She's based, actually, on a woman I saw in the Charing Cross Road, someone who was just coming down towards me, and she was enormous, and I did a double take on her, as was everybody else in the road, because she was wearing leathers. She was the kind of shape and size of a woman who usually wears, well, a muumuu or something and stays at home and hides. But she was striding up the Charing Cross Road with a sort of F.U. expression on her face, and she didn't care, and everybody was looking at her. And that was basically my introduction to Eva, was thinking, what is it like to look like that? In other words, not to look ordinary.
What did you make of this woman who was assertive about how big she was instead of covering it with a muumuu?
Well, I guess I admired her. Well, the next stage was that I met a woman called Klondike Kate, who is also extremely ugly, and she's a wrestler. And this woman, in fact, is more fat than tall. She's the kind of shape where, as I say, most women would not go on a beach. But she gets up and she gets in the ring wearing a leotard. So she's like a barrel in Lycra. And she gets out under the lights and she is herself. And she has to, of course, she has to be a villain because ugly people have to be villains. But the point is she doesn't hide, and I admire that.
How did you meet her?
Well, I started going to some wrestling matches. Basically, when I used to go to wrestling, I used to know someone when I was at art school who was the Canadian heavyweight champion. And in those days, there weren't any women wrestlers. And then I heard by chance that there were some women wrestlers in England. So I just went to have a look, and that's when I saw this woman and went to talk to her afterwards. And it occurred to me that she had really found her niche in life. If you don't want to hide, if you don't want to be invisible, you have to go out there and allow yourself to be hated. And I think it's very rare because women can't stand being hated. Our whole conditioning is towards being approved of, is towards being pretty and approved of. And it seemed to me that I had just seen two people who were doing absolutely the opposite. And it made me kind of reevaluate what sort of went into our conditioning and why.
So you drew on both the wrestler Klondike Kate and on this very large woman who you saw walking down Charing Cross
yes.
Road to create your character.
That's right, yes.
What else did you have to know about your character in order to render her in a believable way?
Well, I think a lot of things start from appearance. They do for me. They appearances go a lot of the way towards how I judge and evaluate a person. And I was thinking about someone who is, well, not to put too fine a point on it, ugly. And I was reckoning that they would be treated badly, and they would have been treated badly since they were children. And some people, when the world treats them badly, they sort of curl up and die. And some people, when the world treats them badly, they treat the world badly back themselves. They want to hit back. They just get bloody angry, if you'll excuse the expression. And it was the bloody angry that I wanted to write about.
So tell us about the persona that you gave Eva. Her name in the ring is the London Assassin.
That's right. Well, she has to be the villain. Nature didn't give her much choice. She has to be the villain because she's ugly. That's the way that society casts ugly women. They become witches and so on. So she cannot, in a way, ever be what they call in wrestling blue eyes. And blue eyes are the guys or the women in the white hats. She has to be a villain. And therefore, she has to judge her success by, well, basically how many people spit at her. If a lot of people boo at her and spit at her and throw things, then she knows she's doing very well. It always struck me as very ironic, that. I like that idea.
Eva is not an educated person. Was there anything in your life that helped you understand a character that grew up without an education, grew up partly in foster homes?
Well, yes. In a way, I feel I'm pretty badly educated myself. I left school when I was 16. I'm a dyslexic, which means that everyone thought I was incredibly thick, and that gets pretty annoying after a while when you're a kid, and it tends to lead to behaviour problems. And then, of course, coming from England, I was sent away to boarding school when I was very young. And so, in that respect, even though my parents paid through the nose for it, it's institutional life, and you are at the mercy of strangers. And so, oh yes, they do say that the British upper and middle classes are very well fitted for prison life. that we get on better in institutions than we do in luxurious hotels. We know how to cope. So in a very strange kind of way, there are a lot of things in common between Eva and me.
So were you assumed to be stupid because you were dyslexic?
Yeah.
Were you put in special classes?
Well, what's known as the D stream. All the bright kids go in the A and so on, A, B, C, and D. By the time you're D, it's more or less remedial. And it's a horrible place to be if you sort of feel you understand things. And I always felt I understood things, it's just I couldn't write them down. And homework would take me sort of about 8 times as long as everybody else. And I would never get the spelling right. So in the end, I'd kind of give up doing it. And when you give up doing it, then you start getting into a spiral of punishment and so on. And so I left school without any qualifications, and actually went to art school on the theory that that was a wonderful place for people who couldn't spell.
So how was your dyslexia diagnosed?
Well, it wasn't. I was 22 years old, and I was looking in a newspaper, and there was an article about dyslexia, and they actually reproduced some writing by dyslexic children. And I looked at this writing, and I thought, blimey, that's me.
What did you recognize in it?
The mirror writing. The fact that, you know, P's and B's, the ups and downs, things switched over. And I just looked at this and I said, that is me. That's the way I was at that age and so on.
And then what happened?
Well, actually, funnily enough, I felt a lot better then. I thought, oh, good, you're handicapped, you're not thick.
Mm-hmm.
And funnily enough, that was a bit of a comfort.
It meant that you weren't stupid, it's just that you had this problem reading and writing.
Right.
So, I mean, obviously you write now, and I have to assume that you read a lot, too. Maybe that's a false assumption, but what led you in that direction after having this obstacle to reading and writing?
Well, I've always read a lot, but just slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I never even wrote shopping lists. I mean, I was totally allergic to the pencil and pen. But I was a reasonably good storyteller, and it was my old man who decided that I should write a book, because we'd been away on holiday in the south of France. We'd had a villa which had been shared by several families, and all the kids were sort of around 10 years old, and it became my job to tell them the story every night, the one which would get them to bed before the adults. And I kept one story going for 2 or 3 weeks. And so he thought that I could write a child's book, whereas, of course, I wasn't in the least bit interested at writing for children. I mean, I like telling children stories because basically when you get stuck, you ask the little suckers what happens next, and they tell you, quite unlike what happens in the adult world. So that's how it started.
Do you have any problems from the dyslexia when you write?
Well, when I'm very tired, I even start at the wrong end of the page. One piece of comfort for dyslexics anywhere is the fact that if you relax and if you stick at it, you get better. I'm not saying that I'm ever going to be Einstein in the writing department, but I'm certainly make fewer mistakes than I used to. And the quality of just relaxing and sort of getting your head into it, it seems to come naturally. But otherwise, I just write and I make all the mistakes that I make. And then I go through it with a dictionary. I write in pencil. And then the person who types for me is a very good speller, or used to be. And that's another thing. A dyslexic can completely discombobulate somebody who thinks they can spell. Because you don't spell one word wrong the same way twice. In fact, if there are 5 different ways to spell a word, you will find all 5. And for someone who really can spell well, they find themselves questioning everything. And so I'm not doing my typists any favor at all.
Well, what about word check? Do you ever use that, spell check?
Well, I don't use a word processor.
That's part of computer programs.
Yes.
Just check the spelling for you.
Yeah. Well, they can, but then again, I use a lot of slang, which mm-hmm. always comes up as being a mistake on spell check. And another thing, being in England, almost all the computer programs for spelling are American spelling, which is interesting.
Oh, I see. So color would be C-O-L-R instead of C-O-L-O-U-R. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm asking the wrong person.
Long pause, yes.
Well, you know, you mentioned the slang that you use. I have to confess, I didn't understand some of it. There's a sentence, "She looked like a film star and talked poncy, but I had the dosh." You want to interpret that for me?
She looked like Michelle Pfeiffer. She talked like Nancy Reagan. But I was Donald Trump.
Oh, that's great. Now, is nut bucket a slang term?
Bucket nut.
Bucket nut, I'm sorry.
Yes, well...
No, that's your job, right?
You see what I mean? Bucket nut really simply means that she's so ugly she's got her face like a bucket. And it was, in fact, a term I overheard someone shouting at Klondike Kate, one of my inspirations for this character. He came rushing up to the front. He was a little old man, you know, who looked as if he wouldn't say boo to a goose, and spittle was flying in every direction, and he couldn't think of anything bad enough to say. He looked like the kind of guy who'd never sworn in his life, especially not at a woman. And he says, you bucket nut, and he comes out with it as if it's the worst swear word in the world, but all it means is that she's got a face like a bucket.
Had you ever heard that before?
No, I hadn't. No, I hadn't heard that one before.
My guest is British mystery writer Liza Cody. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Liza Cody, author of the new mystery novel, Bucket Nut. You've already written a series of detective novels with another character, not with the wrestler who we've been talking about, but with a character named Anna Lee. So I assume that was the first stuff that you started writing when you decided to write.
Yes.
What led you to that area of detective fiction?
Well, I think basically because I just wanted to write stories about things happening. The kind of things that happen to the people I know. I didn't feel that I could write so-called proper literature because I felt that one needed a quality of sort of philosophizing or speculating, which I just don't have. I didn't feel I had anything very important to say, but I felt that I knew a lot of good stories and that I was a fairly good observer of human nature. And I also wanted to have a form which would make me stick to the point, stick to a story and not go off hog wild in any particular direction.
How does your first detective, Anna Lee, compare to your new character, Eva?
Well, Anna, funnily enough, she's a little bit institutionalized as well because she used to be on the police force and has been brought up in a man's world and is therefore has the strengths and weaknesses of any woman who is formed in a man's world. But I think one of her most overriding characteristics is that she tries incredibly hard always to be decent and to do the decent thing. Whereas Eva tries awfully hard to be as indecent and as get away with as much as she possibly can.
When you decided that your character, Anna Lee, was perhaps too decent, had something changed in your life that made you want to create somebody who was less decent?
Yes, I think this is the slow-burning and always developing sense of myself and of women in society. And I think maybe in my own life, I was beginning to be just a little bit restricted and tired of always having to do the right thing, of always having the sort of burden of morality. on me. And people always asking, is this a role model? And so on. As if you can't write about people in their own right, that everything you do has to be a role model for other women. And a role model always has to be the decent, the patient, the kind, the one that nurtures and cares and looks after children. Well, we've got so many sides to our nature. I think that it's time for us to sort of be able to cope with, for instance, anger and rage. I know I have quite a large bank of anger in me at various times, and it seemed, you know, kind of liberating time to let it rip a little bit, and so I did.
So have you found yourself becoming more assertive now that you're writing about such an aggressive character?
Oh, no, I'm a complete wimp. I always have been, always will be. I think women get, I think I've got a bit more salty with age, to tell you the truth. And I'm much less worried about people disapproving of me. I possibly do say what I think and what I feel a lot more than I used to. But not now.
Not now?
Of course not now.
Not right this minute, you mean?
No.
Because it's too public?
Because it's too public, and because when I'm in a really public situation, I find myself absolutely terrified that everyone's going to hate me. And so in that respect, I'm completely unlike Eva, who doesn't give a toss.
Right. Well, I really enjoyed talking with you, and I thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it was great talking to you.
Liza Cody's new novel is Bucket Nut. I want to tell you about a special program we have coming up this Friday, live from the 1993 Public Radio Conference in Washington, D.C. We'll feature a live concert with pop soul singer and songwriter Arthur Alexander. The Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Otis Redding, and Bob Dylan have recorded his songs. Arthur Alexander has just released his first album in 20 years. It's called Lonely Just Like Me, and I want you to hear a song from the record. This is one of Alexander's songs you may recognize, Every Day I Have to Cry.
There was a little girl I had planned to marry. This was my love, I didn't want to share it. I thought that love would make my life bright and sunny. She said she couldn't love me cause I didn't have no money. So every day I have to cry some. Every day I have to cry some. Dry the water from my eyes. I really love her every night. Well, I was thinking of her, but you can't mix love with money. Cause if you do, you're gonna hurt somebody. And every day I have to cry some. Every day I have to cry some. Drop the water from my eyes. Wrong to love cause I'm not a rich man, but you can't mix love with money, cause when you do, you're gonna hurt somebody. And every day I have to cry some. Every day I have to cry some. Drive the water from my eyes.
Arthur Alexander from his new album will feature a live concert with him Friday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet Jimmy Santiago Baca. He grew up in an orphanage in New Mexico, learned to read and write in prison, and when he got out, became an award-winning poet and essayist. Baca also co-wrote the screenplay for the new movie Bound by Honor, about three Chicano men in East L.A. Most books start on page one and end at the end. Not so with a new book by Serbian writer Milorad Pavic. John Leonard reviews The Inner Side of the Wind. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to officials at the White House, the U.S. is working with NATO allies on putting together ground forces for a peacekeeping unit in Bosnia. At the same time, a spokeswoman stresses that the U.S. is going ahead with plans to take military action if Bosnian Serbs do not accept and keep a U.N.-sponsored peace plan. Meanwhile, the International Red Cross says Croatian and Muslim forces in central Bosnia have taken part in a prisoner exchange program. A spokesman says those let go and who want to stay where they are allowed to do so, while others are moved to other areas. A group of retired military officials has launched a national grassroots lobbying campaign to keep homosexuals out of the military. The group, calling itself the Defense Readiness Council, says allowing gays and lesbians into the military would destroy unit cohesion among the troops. NPR's Martha Raddus reports.
The retired brass and enlisted officers say their principal goal is to enact legislation prohibiting homosexuals in the military. Retired Marine Corps General Charles Cooper calls President Clinton's efforts to lift the ban against gays misguided.
Our coming together has been a result of our deep dismay about the shocking lack of understanding President Clinton has shown on this issue.
Retired Army General Herbert Temple Jr. says allowing homosexuals to serve would be an intrusion on the moral character of the military. He says the issue is one of sexual deviation and immorality. As for those gay men and women that already serve, the retired officers referred to them as liars and thieves who have not yet been caught. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
The president's chief health care advisor said today that the Clinton administration's upcoming health care plan will try to eliminate discrimination in health care based on income. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
Presidential advisor Ira Magaziner says the president's plan for health care reform will take steps to ensure equal care for all. He told a meeting of the National Medical Association, which represents black physicians, that the administration's plan will make it easier for people to win lawsuits against health care plans that discriminate against the poor. If a person wanted to sue a health care plan for, say, failing to provide care in poor neighborhoods, the plan would have the burden of proving that it was not discriminating. Magaziner also said that the administration's reforms would also encourage doctors to practice in underserved areas and lure more members of minority groups into the medical field. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 19 points to close at 3,446.46 on volume of more than 221 million shares. Advancing issues led declines. This is NPR News. U.N. diplomat Madeleine Albright says that she's in favor of a standing U.N. military to be used in peacekeeping forces around the world. Testifying today on Capitol Hill, Albright said the U.N. will soon have some 90,000 soldiers involved in more than a dozen peacekeeping operations, and the situation, she said, is becoming dangerously stressful. Albright says the U.N. is being asked to do everything, and it cannot. In her opinion, a standby U.N. force is the path to follow. Government troops in Cambodia have driven off a Khmer Rouge attack on a town in the northwestern part of the nation. UN officials say seven people were killed, including four guerrillas. There is concern that even though the city is calm now, there will be another attack. Ian Simpson of the BBC reports.
As dusk fell on Siem Reap, local soldiers and United Nations troops prepared for the Khmer Rouge to return. Shabbily dressed young soldiers with rockets and automatic weapons slung carelessly over their shoulders trudged slowly out of town to begin a night of waiting for the Khmer Rouge. Meanwhile, at the airport 5 miles away, heavily armed Bangladeshi soldiers were stationed on the roof of the airport building and around the runway. Several hundred Khmer Rouge soldiers stormed into the center of Siem Reap early on Monday morning after launching a sustained attack from four directions. Villagers near the airport said the Khmer Rouge also came to their houses looking for ethnic Vietnamese people and government soldiers. They then burned down several houses and shot one man in the arm because they said he looked Vietnamese.
Ian Simpson reporting for the BBC. According to the National Association of Purchasing Management, the nation's overall economy grew last month, but at its slowest pace in 6 months. The business group says its index of overall economic growth dropped 2.4%. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jimmy Santiago Baca was formed by the years he spent in prison. He recently returned to prison, but it wasn't to do time, it was to make a movie. Baca wrote the screenplay for the new film Bound by Honor about Chicano life in East L.A. Baca also has a part in the film as a prisoner. Baca is part Chicano, part Native American. He grew up in an orphanage and on the streets. He spent several years in prison on drug charges. It was in prison that he learned to read and write. He had a couple of poems published in Mother Jones magazine while he was behind bars. Since getting out, he's had books of poems and essays published and has won the Before Columbus National Book Award, the Wallace Stevens Fellowship from Yale University, and the Pushcart Prize. Baca lives in Albuquerque with his family. He went to San Quentin to shoot the new film, and he was surprised at how he reacted to being back in a prison.
What surprised me was my response to the hyper-reality of it all. You think that during the filming of the film in San Quentin, I sort of went crazy with going back in. And one day, as Taylor Hackford was shooting a scene, I had had enough, and I walked right in front of the camera and stopped the shooting. And I said that I was leaving. And he said, "Well, he says, why? We need you. You can't. You're part of the. You're one of the actors." And I said, "Well, I can't deal with it anymore." So. He let me. He allowed me to. He was kind enough to get me a place where I could just take a few days off and start writing this book to deal with the emotions that I was feeling. And as I began to write this book called "Working in the Dark," I began to write, try to figure out what my response was, what I was feeling in prison. And it was a shock to me that I had lost. I'd been out of prison 12 years, but I had lost all sense of being out and being a free man and having a farm and. Doing all the wonderful things that I do in life, I had forgot all of that and had just plunged back into the abyss of being a convict. And I felt a lot of hatred coming back and a lot of nightmarish grief and a lot of anguish.
You've had a pretty rough life. Let me just run through with you some of the things that have happened to you in your life. You were born both Chicano and Apache descent. Your parents divorced and abandon you when you were 2 years old. Why did they abandon you?
Well, the reasons for that are many. I mean, mostly historical reasons that have to do with colonialism and the 50s after World War II, you know, when they had this huge en masse of homesteaders that had settled and had taken all the land from us, and the courts were reaffirming the robbery and they were legitimizing it. And you had all these people that were starving during the great droughts. You know, in Oklahoma and New Mexico and Texas, and people were moving. They were. You know, so I mean, the reasons are many, but I suppose they were. My father was trying to become. I mean, prove he was American, was forced to come to the urban centers to work, and my mother, on the other hand, went the other route and was trying to marry an Anglo so that she could be accepted or feel like she was acceptable.
But why did they abandon you?
Well, for the reasons I just explained. For all those reasons, the economic reasons, there may have been no money, the reasons of the drought in the pueblos, for the reason of them coming to the cities and wanting to assimilate into America, you know. I mean, those reasons, they left me with my grandma, and they took. I guess the reason they abandoned me was they didn't know how to take care of themselves. They were being assaulted and assailed from all sides. Well, you know, I mean, and when that happens, how can you cope with taking care of kids when you can't even take care of yourself?
How did you end up in an orphanage?
I was taken there because the authorities thought it was bad influence for me to be around the the people in my pueblo. They thought that I should learn how to speak English and be a Catholic.
Did you identify more as Native American or Chicano or both, or did it matter?
Well, you find out that despite all the catastrophic the cyclones and all of the whirlwinds occurring around me as a child, I found that the safe place to be was on the playground with the kids. And it's funny because the little white boys that were there from the mountains and the black kids and the Chicano kids and the Indian kids all sort of became, their ethnicity became neutral, because when you're poor and abandoned and you're swinging on a swing with a kid or sliding down a slider in the pool or on the merry-go-round or the teeter-totter, you don't think so much what the kid is from or where he's at, because it seems that the similarity in experiences dissolve differences in ethnicity. And so we were all just a bunch of kids who were there, suffering from the same situations and enjoying the same benefits.
So you left the orphanage when you were 12. Did you run away, or did they release you? What was the story?
Well, I ran away a lot of times. I had as Pablo Neruda says in one of his poems, I had little tiny flames shooting out from my heels, as most children do. But I ran away many times, and I ran away on the last, they were going to send me to Boys Town, and I ran away.
When you were 12?
Yeah. So ultimately, I just never came back.
So where did you live? How did you live?
Well, I hustled. I mean, I didn't really hustle that much. I really depended on the kindness and the generosity of my people. And I lived with many friends' families, and they gave me, like, they would give me a meal. And they would give me food, and then the hardest part about living on the streets as a kid is when the rest of the kids are in school, and the grown-up adults have gone to work, and you're left with the very ancient or the handicapped or the invalids. You sort of people the world with them, and you begin to think there must be something wrong with you too, that you're one of the damaged ones.
My guest is Jimmy Santiago Baca. He wrote the screenplay for the new film Bound by Honor. His latest book is Writing in the Dark, Reflections of a Poet in the Barrio. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Jimmy Santiago Baca. How did you end up in prison?
They have a law in 1972 and 71 that said it was a ridiculous law, and it was primarily responsible for breaking the boundaries of prison room and for rooming and selling 3-4 people to a cell, which is really crazy. But I was in the vicinity where the commission of a crime took place, and since it was re-election, it was a Mormon county, it was a Mormon judge, a Mormon lawyers and all that, and it was re-election time, and everybody in that town hates Mexicans and that whole thing. They really did take a tour de force on this, and took everybody in that was there when everybody knew it was one person's fault, but they gave a friend of mine 50 to 90 years. They gave my girlfriend 3 solid years in a maximum security prison, and she was from the Juilliard School in New York. She was practicing music, and she had nothing to do with anything. Neither did I, for that matter. But anyway, you know how that goes. They rounded up a bunch of people, and then the spectacular news of the day was this and that. And so it was a real lifeline for the judicial system in Yuma, Arizona, to make for their heyday. You know.
So what were the charges?
Drugs, possession with the intent to sell, to distribute.
And were you dealing at the time?
Of course not. The judges knew that, and the lawyers knew that. They all knew it. It was just, they said to me, look, this is how America works. You know, you waste our time, you're going to get worse. Plead guilty, and we go on to the next case, and we'll be easy on you.
How old were you the first time you were sent to prison?
I was 18.
And you couldn't read?
Well, you know, functionally illiterate. Anybody can read it or you or a, and, but. But it's quite another thing to... It's not so much the fact that you can read or not read. I couldn't read. But it's what happens to an individual who's not able to read. What condition does that person fall into?
Well, did it ever bother you before then that you couldn't read?
Quite a bit.
Were you embarrassed by it?
Never embarrassed.
Mm-hmm. So tell me more about how being in prison led you to start reading.
Well, you know, I wanted to go to take my GED, and they refused to let me take my GED. They want me to work, so I told them I'm not working until I get privileges to go to school. And that was it. We stayed at that impasse for the entire time I was in prison.
Were you punished for your position?
Of course, yeah. I was punished very severely, many times. And I never did work, though, I'm proud to say.
Did you get to study for your GED?
Never.
So how did you start to read?
Well, there was a guy named Harry who was a good Samaritan in Phoenix who wrote me a letter saying, what do I need? For Christmas, you know, he picked my name out of a hat and said, you know, well, this Christmas time, you don't have anybody to visit or anybody, so what would you like? And I told him, well, could you send me a book, English and a Spanish book, so I could learn what verbs are and nouns and stuff? And he did. And I took off. I got a bunch of books from the other convicts, and I started reading and writing. And I started writing letters and poems and everything for the convicts, and they gave me coffee, cigarettes, pencils, tablets, and I started a very thriving bartering system.
Do you remember anything you wrote? Any of the letters or poems that you wrote for other people inside?
I remember the first stanza I ever wrote in my life that I think had carried some fire to it. I was in the shower, taking a shower, and it struck me, and I ran out naked, ran down the tier, ran into my cell, and jotted it down with wet, soapy hands.
What was it?
It was just a four-line, two couplets. It was, did you tell them hell is not a dream, and that you've been there, did you tell them? And it came because of, we had a visit from a group of citizens to prison, and they sort of went around, you know, they sort of walked around without taking stock of very much, or... I mean, you know, mostly just the impotent routine of people just coming to take a look and walking out. And did you tell them that hell, that you've been there and that hell is not a dream, did you tell them? Seemed to me to resonate with something that was volcanically brewing beneath me somewhere.
Were you able to read that to someone after you wrote it?
No, except the birds. Birds and the trees and the air and the dust and the sun outside my window.
How much did you want somebody else to hear it when you wrote that?
Well, not very much. I mean, I didn't think I was going to be a poet or a writer. My goal in life was to be an English teacher. So what I was writing, I wasn't particularly gung-ho about having people hear it or even read it because I didn't think I was a poet. I didn't think I was a writer. I was simply trying to grasp the language. And in doing so, I kept a journal. I kept many journals. And it wasn't until Mother Jones... I sent three poems to them, and I didn't know how to put the stamp or the address on the letter or anything, but I did send them three poems, and they published the poems internationally and sent me $300, and I was like, wow.
So were you was the $300 held for you till you were released?
No, they put it in my store, and I bought ice cream for the whole cell block.
You treated everybody.
Yeah, since everybody had been supporting me for a few years, I decided it was my turn to give them something.
Can I ask you to read a poem from your collection, Immigrants in Our Own Land, and
yeah.
Selected Early Poems? The poem is called Cloudy Day.
Cloudy Day.
First, tell us when you wrote this.
Well, I remember I was standing outside, and I guess it was about 77, 78, something like that.
You were in prison?
Yeah. Cloudy Day. It is windy today. A wall of wind crashes against, windows clunk against, iron frames as wind swings past broken glass and seethes, like a frightened cat in empty spaces of the cell block. In the exercise yard, we sat huddled in our prison jackets on our haunches against the fence, and the wind carried our words over the fence,
while the vigilant guard on the tower held his cap at the sudden gust. I could see the main tower from where I sat, and the wind in my face gave me the feeling I could grasp the tower like a cornstalk and snap it from its roots of rock. The wind plays it like a flute, this hollow shoot of rock. The brim girded with barbed wire, with a guard sitting there also, listening intently to the sounds as clouds cover the sun. I thought of the day I was coming to prison in the back seat of a police car. Hands and ankles chained, the policeman pointed. You see that big water tank, Bear Boy? The big silver one out there sticking up. That there's prison. And here I am. I cannot believe it. Sometimes it is such a dream, where I stand up in the face of the wind like now it blows at my jacket and my eyelids flick a little bit while I stare, disbelieving. The third day of spring, and 4 years later, I can tell you how a man can endure, how a man can become so cruel, how he can die or become so cold. I can tell you this. I've seen it every day, and still I'm strong enough to love you, love myself, and feel good. Even as the earth shakes and trembles and I have not a thing to my name, I feel as if I have everything, everything.
Was that written for a person?
It's written for me.
You've been out of prison for 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us something about what your life is like now. You live on a farm.
Oh, it's exciting. I go to Mexico City in 2 days. I'm going to meet Octavio and Gabriel Garcia Marquez in Cartagena, and I'm writing feverishly, and I've got wonderful books that I'm working on, and I read a lot, and I've got incredible children, and I've got... You know what I was doing this morning?
What?
I was planting flowers. I was starting a garden. Me and my children were planting flowers. And there was a peacock. I don't know where it came from, but it flew into my yard, and my horse was gone. I don't know where my horse went. You know, I'm up to my neck. I got invited to the New Orleans Jazz Festival, and I got all these programs for kids who are barefoot and hungry and illiterate, and I'm working with them. And I can't really ask for much more right now. I'm busted broke, but what are you going to do about that, right? I mean, I've got everything else but money, so I'm not complaining.
Jimmy, thank you a lot for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Jimmy Santiago Baca wrote the screenplay for the new film, Bound by Honor. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, now that the leader of the Bosnian Serbs has agreed to sign the Vance Owen peace plan, what do you have on the peace process?
Well, first we're going to review what's in the Vance Owen plan, how it's been changed recently and what it actually consists of, how it would be enforced, and we'll be hearing some conflicting views from Capitol Hill on whether the U.S. should still be threatening the use of military force if there are violations of the Vance Owen peace plan. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about U.S. policy toward El Salvador back in the 1980s and what really was the truth and who was telling it. And we'll also be hearing about new standardized tests for students in the state of Delaware.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. As we all follow the latest news from the Balkans, John Leonard has a review of a new novel by Serbian writer Milorad Pavic. Pavic lives in Belgrade. His books include Dictionary of the Khazars, Landscape Painted with Tea, and the new novel The Inner Side of the Wind.
After Dictionary of the Khazars, in which Milorad Pavic reimagined the Balkans at the end of the first millennium as a lexicon in male and female volumes, after Landscape Painted with Tea, in which he reimagined the history of the Eastern Orthodox Church as a crossword puzzle we could read either horizontally or vertically. What the wicked postmodernist from the former Yugoslavia does to us this time is reimagine the old Greek tale of Hero and Leander, and we have to read half of it upside down. What I mean is, Leander here is an 18th-century stonemason who tells his story in one novella that stops halfway through the book. And then we have to turn the book over, upside down, where there's another front cover and another novella, from the point of view of Hero, a 20th-century Serbian translator of French literature, or vice versa. It doesn't matter which end of the book you read first, though I recommend starting with Leander since at least it's chronological. Anyway, while this hero and this Leander never meet, they do converge. About the original hero in Leander, you'll remember that she was a priestess of Venus, and he used to swim across the Hellespont every night for hanky-panky. When he drowned, she too threw herself into the sea. It's not clear from the Greek poet Musaeus, or from Christopher Marlowe, which sea this was, the Aegean or the Marmara, because the Hellespont, now called the Dardanelles, connects the two, as it also divides Europe from Asia. Pavich is up to something here that's even trickier than what Lord Byron did with Hero and Leander. What Byron did was swim the 4-mile distance personally and time himself, 1 hour, 10 minutes, allowing for drift. What Pavich does is make us believe that the lovers were divided not by water, but by time. And so is Europe separated from Asia, not by water, but by time. When Pavich tells us that the inner side of the wind is the one that remains dry when the wind blows through the rain, wind is also a metaphor for time. Leander, like the rest of us, is swimming through waves of time. And so, of course, we all drown. It's nice to meet Leander, who leaves Belgrade because he's faster than everybody else at whatever he does, which ruins his sex life. So he hits the old Constantinople road as a merchant, and then joins a monastery, and then has to flee with the rest of the West when the Turks cross the Danube in 1739. On this retreat, Leander will build churches, which the Turks burn promptly down, until he's back in Belgrade, where he must deal with his dream of a saber and a beheading, like John the Baptist. And it's heartbreaking to meet Hero, who sneaks her own fiction into her translations of Pierre Loti, and keeps a register of dreams, including angels and unicorns and panthers, and is stuck in French in the future perfect tense, having lost her past and present, until she goes to Prague in 1920 and falls in love with the wrong man, an Austrian army lieutenant, with a saber. I'm not saying whose severed head it is that screams. I'm also mum on the death masks and the vault of violins. As always in postmodernism, there is a subversive subtext to this Byzantine games playing. Pavich is telling us something about how and why Serbs feel as they do, not only about Islam in the East, but also about the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Read carefully.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Inner Side of the Wind by Milorad Pavich. The last name is spelled P-A-V-I-C. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Ethnic fighting is tearing apart regions around the world, and racial tension is dividing America. On the next Fresh Air, we'll have a roundtable discussion about the politics of identity. We'll be joined by feminist writer Ellen Willis, Palestinian-American culture critic Edward Said, and professor of African-American studies Gail Pemberton. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.